Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from the June 23rd, 2017 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Sessions denies collusion as Trump eyes Mueller. What happened? Attorney General Jeff Sessions this week heatedly denied having colluded with Russia's attempt to influence the 2016 presidential campaign amid reports that President Donald Trump had to be talked out of firing the special counsel now investigating the Russia scandal. In testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, Sessions said the insinuation that his meetings with the Russian ambassador during the campaign meant that he was cooperating with Moscow was an appalling and detestable lie. The former Alabama senator defended writing a memo justifying Trump's firing of Comey, saying his recusal from campaign-related investigations cannot interfere with my ability to oversee the Department of Justice, including the FBI. Sessions recused himself from overseeing the Russia investigation in March after admitting to two previously undisclosed meetings with Russian ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak. Sessions testified this week he had no memory of a reported third meeting with the ambassador. To the frustration of Democratic senators, Sessions repeatedly insisted it was inappropriate to discuss his private conversations with the president about why Comey was fired or any other matter. Comey last week provided the Senate Intelligence Committee with detailed accounts of his interactions with Trump and his team. Comey said he took detailed notes on the encounter because he was concerned the president might lie about them later, and admitted leaking these memos after he was fired in order to force the Justice Department to appoint a special counsel. Trump said Comey's testimony was full of false statements and lies, but said it also gave him total and complete vindication. Christopher Ruddy, a longtime friend of the president's, revealed this week that Trump was considering firing Robert Mueller, the special counsel who's taken over the Russia investigation. Trump's aides have talked him out of that extreme step for now, the New York Times reported. But White House sources told the Times that Trump might change his mind. What the editorial said. Sessions' testimony was a mess of obfuscation and contradiction, said the New York Times. The Attorney General insisted he couldn't discuss his conversations with the president because of some long-standing Justice Department policy, yet couldn't confirm that it existed in writing or that, if it did, he had actually read it. He claimed his recommendation to fire Comey was based on the former director's handling of the Clinton investigation, even though he originally praised Comey for announcing new emails had been found 11 days before the election. Anytime he was asked a difficult question, Sessions refused to answer or said he didn't recall. There are legitimate concerns about Mueller, said the New York Post. Three of the Justice Department investigators he has hired have given political donations to the Democrats, and Mueller is known to be good friends with Comey. But for Trump to fire Mueller would be a monumental mistake. He'd have to order Mueller's supervisor, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, to do the actual firing, and Rosenstein would likely refuse and resign, prompting a repeat of Watergate's Saturday night massacre. More importantly, firing Mueller would strongly suggest that Trump has something to hide. Don't do it, Mr. President. What the columnist said. If Sessions' testimony revealed anything, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post, it's that Trump is genuinely uninterested in finding out how much Russia interfered in our election. Sessions admitted he could not remember a single occasion on which the president expressed concern or curiosity about the issue. Trump clearly sees the investigation as a hassle, not an important step toward assuring the sanctity of American elections. Sessions doesn't deserve this public thrashing, said Greg Jarrett in FoxNews.com. The canard that he misled senators at his confirmation hearing about his meetings with Kislyak was always based on a simple misunderstanding. Sessions has explained that he met with Kislyak as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, not as a member of Trump's campaign team. That's why he didn't report it. Maybe so, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. But the president made a mistake in hiring Sessions. As a member of the campaign team, the attorney general knew almost from day one that he would have to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. That ultimately led to the appointment of Mueller as a special counsel, leaving Trump's fate in the hands of an unrestrained, independent investigation. If you think Trump won't fire Mueller, think again, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. As Comey's dismissal made clear, the president has no intrinsic respect for political norms, and he finds it intolerable to be under investigation. More importantly, he has found that Republicans and his water carriers on Fox News will support him no matter what he does. The president is a creature of impulses, and at some point, he'll find it impossible to repress his instinct to rid himself of the irritating Mueller. Our controversy of the week, Comey. Did he damage Trump? President Trump is in deep trouble, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. That was the undeniable takeaway from last week's testimony by former FBI Director James Comey before the Senate Intelligence Committee, which clearly marked a turning point in the running melodrama of Trump's troubled presidency. Comey testified that the president summoned him to an awkward one-on-one dinner at the White House, where he asked if he wanted to keep his job, and then ominously said, "I expect loyalty." At a later group meeting in the Oval Office, Comey testified, "Trump ordered everyone else out of the room and pressured him to drop the FBI investigation of fired National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go," Trump allegedly said. These statements, along with Trump's firing of Comey when he refused to bend to his will, look very much like obstruction of justice, an impeachable offense. Why was Trump so determined to get Comey to back off the investigation? Asked Noah Rothman in NYDailyNews.com. You can only conclude he was very afraid of what a deep dive into his campaign associates' interactions with Russia might reveal. It is never a good day when a former FBI director calls you a liar, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. But Comey's testimony ended up being a net plus for Trump. For one thing, Comey corroborated the president's claim, previously ridiculed by the media, that Comey assured Trump three times that he wasn't personally under investigation. It may have been clumsy, naive, and smarmy for the president to express hope that Comey would let the Flynn investigation go, but the fact that Comey ignored him proves it wasn't an order or a crime. Trump-hating Democrats are desperate to get the president impeached, but if Trump can just settle down and let Mueller do his work, the Russia investigation and all its subsidiaries will conclude without evidence of crime. Trump's defenders are in denial, said Ali Soufan in TheAtlantic.com. As a former FBI agent, I can read between the lines of Comey's testimony, and he said several things that should keep Trump and his lawyers up nights. He made it clear several of Trump's campaign aides are under investigation for their mysterious contacts with Russia, and Trump was the head of the campaign. When the feds build a case against an organization, they start at the bottom and work upward, turning the lower ranks into informants as they go. And look who's already under investigation. Flynn, Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, former campaign advisor Carter Page, and former campaign chairman Paul Manafort. Bear in mind, too, that obstruction of justice is just as much a crime as collusion with a foreign power. When asked if the president had obstructed justice, Comey said he was sure the special counsel, his friend and FBI mentor Mueller would make that part of his investigation. In FBI culture, said Jeff Stein in Newsweek, Russia is viewed as an enemy, and any American who colludes with the Russians as a traitor is a traitor. To us, Comey said, that is a very big deal. Translation, Mueller and his team of top-notch federal prosecutors will tear the White House down, searching for any evidence of collusion. If anyone connected to Trump had improper contact or financial transactions with Vladimir Putin's henchmen and spies, Mueller will find out. Trump should have little doubt about that now. It was a good week for sycophancy after President Trump turned a cabinet meeting into a testimonial to his incredible leadership, with Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, Health Secretary Tom Price, and more than a dozen others taking turns saying it was a blessing and an incredible honor and privilege to work for him. It was a good week for making good, after a British professor kept his promise to eat pages of his pro-Brexit book live on TV if he got the UK election results wrong. It's a hardback, so there are a lot of chemicals, said Matthew Goodwin, as he chewed the pages. And it was a good week for posterity after Representative Mike Quigley, Democrat from Illinois, introduced a bill to enshrine all of President Trump's tweets in the National Archives. The proposed law is called the Communications Over Various Feeds Electronically for Engagement, or COVFEFE Act. But it was a bad week for inclusion and diversity after the Charlotte, North Carolina Gay Pride organization refused to let a Gays for Trump float participate in the summer parade, saying the group does not reflect the values of our organization. It was a bad week for legal tender after Jackson City, Michigan officials refused to accept a resident's payment of $270 fine because he made it in pennies. We are not the servants of the city government, fumed resident Brian McGonigal. The city is the servant of us. And it was a bad week for ruses after a Florida man was charged with abusing 911 when he called police for a ride to the parking lot of a Hooters restaurant, where he claimed his grandmother had suffered a stroke. Police found no grandma there. And before we leave the page, I'll read you a boring but important short titled, Sessions Targets Medical Marijuana. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has asked congressional leaders to allow the Justice Department to prosecute medical marijuana providers. In a May letter made public this week, Sessions asked lawmakers to undo federal medical marijuana protections, arguing that the bipartisan 2014 amendment, which prohibits the Justice Department from interfering with laws in the 30 states that have legalized medical marijuana, was unwise in the midst of a historic drug epidemic. The drug epidemic Sessions refers to is an opioid, not marijuana, crisis, and Representative Dana Rohrabacher, who sponsored the amendment, said that the move would harm veterans and other suffering Americans who are helped dramatically by medical marijuana. On the briefing page now, titled, The Battle Over Medicaid. Obamacare expanded Medicaid to cover more Americans, but Republicans say the program for the poor is too costly. Who does Medicaid cover? Signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965, The program originally covered four main groups of those without the means to pay for medical care: children, pregnant women, people with disabilities, and elderly people needing long-term care. In 2014, the Affordable Care Act allowed states to expand Medicaid to cover able-bodied adults earning up to 138% of the federal poverty level. That was $16,394 in 2016. That helped add nearly 17 million people to the rolls in 31 states, plus D.C., and brought the number of Americans covered under Medicaid to 74 million, including the Children's Health Insurance Program. The expansion played a major role in reducing the number of Americans who don't have health insurance from 14.3% in 2013 to 8.6% last year. But the cost of providing this coverage was steep. The state and federal government spent $574 billion on Medicaid last year. The Republicans say the trajectory of growth in the program is simply unsustainable, setting up a major struggle over Medicaid's future. "I think there will be an incredible tug of war," said Representative Mark Sanford, Republican from South Carolina. What do Republicans want to do? In legislation that House Republicans passed and sent on to the Senate, GOP leaders proposed phasing out Medicaid expansion by 2020 and reducing the projected spending on the program by $834 billion over a decade. That bill, called the American Health Care Act, would cut $875 billion in taxes, mostly on high earners, that are being used to pay for Obamacare. Republicans want Washington to give states limited amounts of money for Medicaid based on either a block grant or per capita formula, letting states figure out how best to spend it. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that the Republican plan would ultimately ensure 14 million fewer Medicaid recipients than the current law. Senate Republicans are rewriting the House bill, and Medicaid is reported to be a major sticking point. Moderates have proposed a phase out of Medicaid expansion over 7 years instead of three to soften the blow on recipients and delay the political consequences for Republicans. How well does Medicaid work? Not surprisingly, Republicans and Democrats disagree on that topic. Republican critics call the program bloated, rife with fraud, and inefficient, and say its low payments to doctors result in inferior care. They often cite a 2013 study that compared a group of low-income Oregon residents who were on Medicaid with those who weren't. The study concluded that Medicaid generated no significant improvement in measured physical outcomes for diabetes, high cholesterol, or high blood pressure, or even for mortality rates. Medicaid patients did show substantial improvements in mental health, at least partly because they knew they could see doctors without crippling out-of-pocket costs. But other Medicaid studies have concluded the program does improve overall health. What did they find? A Harvard study found a significant 6% decrease in mortality in the affected population in states that expanded Medicaid, compared with those that didn't. The nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation says that its review of the research shows that Medicaid recipients are as likely as privately insured adults to have doctor visits, specialist care, and preventative screening, and that 85% are satisfied with their medical care. Research shows consistently that Medicaid improves access to care, said Kaiser analyst Julia Paradise. Democrats warned that the Republicans' plan to cap Medicaid spending would force states to ration health care for the poor and cut benefits to the disabled, mentally ill, and elderly people. They also contend that limiting Medicaid spending would create a crisis for the nursing home care. Does Medicaid fund that care? Medicaid covers home health aides and nursing home care once a patient's own savings are exhausted. More than 60% of all nursing home residents are currently covered by Medicaid, and such care consumes 21% of all Medicaid spending. In coming years, the need for nursing home coverage will almost surely grow dramatically as baby boomers age and people live longer. The government estimates that about 70% of Americans will require long-term care. Some 80% of those will rely on home health aides at an average cost of $46,000 annually. About 18% will receive care in a nursing home where the cost of a semi-private room averages more than $82,000 a year. Is Medicaid reform possible? Republicans say spending can and must be limited. The status quo is unacceptable, says Seema Verma, President Trump's new head for the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Verma allows states to require Medicaid recipients to pay premiums rather than get care for free. A work requirement may be imposed for able-bodied recipients. She and other Republicans argue that Medicaid should primarily serve as a temporary bridge for people until they can get their own health care, rather than encouraging dependence on the government. As Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker puts it, we should treat public assistance more like a trampoline than a hammock. Moving into the columns now, this from the United Kingdom. May's big election gamble backfires. Theresa May is a zombie prime minister, said Andrew Rawnsley in The Observer. The early election she called with the naked purpose of crushing all opposition, but instead demolished her own authority. May sought a strong mandate for the so-called hard Brexit, which would yank Britain out of the European Union's trade and labor market, saying she'd consider the vote a failure if a ruling Conservative Party lost 6 seats in Parliament. It ended up losing 13 seats, and with them, its parliamentary majority. The Conservatives took 42% of the vote last week, just a nose ahead of Labour, which, after being written off as a lost cause, won 40%. May's drubbing was a result of her campaign, which combined vanity with incompetence. Billed by Conservatives as the second coming of Margaret Thatcher, she appeared robotic in encounters with the public and had to U-turn on a hugely unpopular manifesto pledge to charge the elderly more for social care, a policy critics called a dementia tax. May now hopes to cling to power with a volatile coalition composed of Northern Ireland's homophobic anti-abortion Democratic Unionist Party and a Conservative Party that has lost faith in her as a leader. It's only a matter of time before she is replaced as Prime Minister. The election debacle shows that the Conservatives need a dramatic reboot, said the Daily Telegraph in an editorial. May must offer an optimistic explanation of why free market solutions are better than many state ones. If she can't manage that, she should make way for a Conservative who can. Negotiations with the EU begin next week, and the country needs a leader who can sound thrilled by Brexit, not talk of it as if it were a natural disaster. That's impossible because nobody is happy with the Brexit, said Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times. Last year's referendum was narrowly won by the Brexiteers, 52% to 48%, only with flagrant lies and promises that the UK would stay in the single market. May then hijacked that result to claim total democratic authority for an extremist coup, and look what happened. Voters flocked to Labour. Pundits had written off Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn as too far left, but he inspired an astonishing revival of his party, said the New Statesman. More than half of voters aged 35 or younger chose labor, and two-thirds of those under 25 did. After 7 years of conservative cuts to public services, they are tired of austerity. Labor's populist manifesto resonated with its calls to make college free for all, renationalize the railways, and raise taxes on the wealthiest. And Corbyn warded off accusations of being weak on national security by promising to maintain Britain's nuclear deterrent and boost police hiring. Of course, Labour did not win and needs to do more to woo moderate voters. If the party can do that, it could easily secure a majority in the next election, which many expect to be called before the end of the year. And an international column from Qatar. Will it bend to Saudi Arabia? It's high time Qatar was brought to heel, said Abdurrahman al-Rashid in Arab News. For years, this tiny Arab state, population 2.7 million, has tried to play both sides of the Middle East Great Divide. Qatar hosts a U.S. military base and pretends to be an ally of its Arab neighbors. Yet it has maintained close ties with Shiite Iran and promotes and funds Sunni extremists. The Muslim Brotherhood's spiritual leader, Egyptian-born Yusuf al-Qaradawi, calls Qatar his home, as do clerics sympathetic to al-Qaeda. The country is also behind Al Jazeera, the satellite news network that spreads lies and hatred around the world. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and three other Arab nations have now had enough, said Jamal Banoun in Al Hayat. The country has recently severed diplomatic and transport links with Qatar and ordered its nationals out. Qatar has called the cutoff a siege, noting that some 40% of its food imports come from Saudi Arabia. But in fact, it is a fully legal boycott. What will happen next is clear. Prices will skyrocket in Qatar, and tourism will wither. Doha will have to see wisdom and capitulate, close Al Jazeera, and expel terrorists. This outrageous hostile act will backfire, said Sultan Barakat in AlJazeera.com. Qatar has striven to be open to all, a country where representatives of the Taliban, political leaders from the Palestinian group Hamas, and U.S. generals can all operate. This has allowed Doha to play mediator and help resolve some of the most intractable conflicts in the region. The Saudis are clearly upset that Qatar has maintained an independent foreign policy, particularly that it has relations with their arch foe, Iran. But given Qatar's geostrategic vulnerability, it is a peninsula jutting from Saudi Arabia into the Arabian Gulf just across from Iran, with which it shares ownership of the world's largest natural gas field, such a policy was essential. Indeed, Saudi bullying shows the wisdom of cooperation with Iran. The blockade will only hasten Qatar's efforts to ensure its security and independence from its Gulf neighbors. Already, Iran is flying in food shipments, while Turkey has deployed troops to its Qatar base. The Saudis are just doing America's bidding, said Ibrahim Karagul and Yeni Safak from Turkey. It's no coincidence that a matter of weeks after President Trump was feted with sword dancing in Saudi Arabia, a blockade fell on Qatar and ISIS launched twin terrorist attacks in Tehran, killing 17 people. The U.S. is trying to provoke a war between the Shiite and Sunni Muslim superpowers, Iran and Saudi Arabia, so that it can take advantage of the chaos and plunder the region's oil and natural gas wealth. No country is going to be able to stay outside this conflict. The Americans will make us all choose sides. Are you with Tehran or Riyadh? I am afraid they are going to get the people of the region to destroy the region. Time for The Last Word, our in-depth article. Title this week, Searching for the Spark of Genius. Some minds, think Michelangelo or Albert Einstein, are so extraordinary that they change the world, said writer Claudia Galb. The origins of such genius are unclear, but science is beginning to offer clues. The Mütter Museum in Philadelphia houses an array of singular medical specimens. On the lower level, the fused livers of 19th century co-joined twins Chang and Ing float in a glass vessel. Nearby, visitors can gawk at the bladder stones of Chief Justice John Marshall and a thigh bone from a Civil War soldier with the wounding bullet still in place. But there's one exhibit near the entrance that elicits unmatchable awe. You can see smudge marks left by museum goers pressing their foreheads against the glass. The object that fascinates them is a small wooden box containing 46 microscope slides, each displaying a slice of Albert Einstein's brain. These remnants of tissue are mesmerizing even though, or perhaps because, they reveal little about the physicist's vaunted powers of cognition. Other displays in the museum show disease and disfigurement. Einstein's brain represents potential, the ability of one exceptional mind to catapult ahead of everyone else. Throughout history, rare individuals have stood out for their meteoric contributions to a field. Lady Murasaki for her literary inventiveness, Michelangelo for his masterful touch, Marie Curie for her scientific acuity. The genius, wrote German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, lights on his age like a comet into the paths of the planets. Consider Einstein's impact on physics. With no tools at his disposal other than the force of his own thoughts, he predicted in his general theory of relativity that massive accelerating objects, like black holes orbiting each other, would create ripples in the fabric of space-time. It took 100 years, enormous computational power, and massively sophisticated technology to definitively prove him right, with a physical detection of such gravitational waves less than 2 years ago. Einstein revolutionized our understanding of the very laws of the universe, but our understanding of how a mind like his works remains stubbornly earthbound. What set his brain power, his thought processes, apart from those of his merely brilliant peers? Philosophers have long been pondering the origins of genius. Early Greek thinkers believed an overabundance of black bile, one of the four bodily humors proposed by Hippocrates, endowed poets, philosophers, and other eminent souls with exalted powers. Phrenologists attempted to find genius in bumps on the head. Craniometrists collected skulls, including philosopher Immanuel Kant's, which they probed, measured, and weighed. None of them discovered a single source of genius, and such a thing is unlikely to be found. Genius is too elusive, too subjective, too wedded to the verdict of history to be easily identified. And it requires the ultimate expression of too many traits to be simplified into the highest point on one human scale. Instead, we can try to understand it by unraveling the complex and tangled qualities, intelligence, creativity, perseverance, and simple good fortune, to name a few, that entwine to create a person capable of changing the world. Intelligence has often been considered the default yardstick of genius, measurable quality generating tremendous accomplishment. Lewis Terman, the Stanford University psychologist who helped pioneer the IQ test, believed a test that captured intelligence would also reveal genius. In the 1920s, he began tracking more than 1,500 California school kids with IQs generally above 140, a threshold he labeled as near genius or genius, to see how they fared in life and how they compared with other children. Terman and his collaborators followed the participants, nicknamed termites, for their lifetimes and mapped their successes in a series of reports. The group included members of the National Academy of Sciences, politicians, doctors, professors, and musicians. 40 years after the study began, the researchers documented the thousands of academic reports and books the termites published, as well as the number of patents they were granted, 350, and short stories they wrote, about 400. But monumental intelligence on its own is no guarantee of monumental achievement, as Terman and his collaborators would discover. A number of the study's participants struggled to thrive, despite their towering IQ scores. Several dozen flunked out of college at first. Others tested for the study, but with IQs that weren't high enough to make the cut, grew up to be renowned in their fields. Most famously, Luis Alvarez and William Shockley, both of whom won Nobel Prizes in physics. There's precedent for such underestimation. Charles Darwin recalled being considered a very ordinary boy, rather below the common standard in intellect. As an adult, he solved the mystery of how the splendid diversity of life came into being. Scientific breakthroughs like Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection would be impossible without creativity, a strand of genius that Terman couldn't measure. But creativity and its processes can be explained to a certain extent by creative people themselves. Scott Barry Kaufman, scientific director of the Imagination Institute in Philadelphia, has been bringing together individuals who stand out as trailblazers in their fields, people like psychologist Steven Pinker and comedian Ann Libera of The Second City, to talk about how their ideas and insights are kindled. Kaufman's goal is not to elucidate genius, but to nurture imagination in everyone. These discussions have revealed that the aha moment, the flash of clarity that arises at unexpected times, in a dream, in the shower, on a walk, often emerges after a period of contemplation. Information comes in consciously, but the problem is processed unconsciously, the resulting solution leaping out when the mind least expects it. Great ideas don't tend to come when you're narrowly focusing on them, said Kaufman. Studies of the brain hint at how those aha moments might happen. The creative process, says Rex Jung, a neuroscientist at the University of New Mexico, relies on the dynamic interplay of neural networks operating in concert and drawing from different parts of the brain at once, both the right and left hemispheres, and especially regions in the prefrontal cortex. One of these networks fosters our ability to meet external demands, activities we must perform like going to work and paying our taxes, and resides largely in outer areas of the brain. The other cultivates internal thought processes, including daydreaming and imagining, and stretches mainly across the brain's middle region. Jazz improvisation provides a compelling example of how neural networks interact during the creative process. Charles Lim, a hearing specialist and auditory surgeon at University of California, San Francisco, designed an iron-free keyboard small enough to be played inside the confines of an MRI scanner. Six jazz pianists were asked to play a scale and a piece of memorized music, and then to improvise solos as they listened to the sounds of a jazz quartet. Their scans demonstrate that brain activity was fundamentally different while the musicians were improvising, said Lim. The internal network associated with self-expression showed increased activity, while the outer network, linked to focused attention and also self-censoring, quieted down. It's almost as if the brain turned off its own ability to criticize itself, he says. This may help explain the astounding performances of jazz pianist Keith Jarrett. Jarrett, who improvises concerts that last for as long as 2 hours, finds it difficult, impossible actually, to explain how his music takes shape. I'm bypassing the brain completely, he tells me. I am being pulled by a force that I can only be thankful for. Even as neuroscientists try to understand how the brain fosters paradigm-shifting thought processes, other researchers are wrestling with the question of when and from what this capacity develops. Are geniuses born or made? Over the past several decades, scientists have been searching for genes that contribute to intelligence, behavior, and even unique qualities like perfect pitch. In the case of intelligence, this research triggers ethical concerns about how it might be used. It is also exceedingly complex, as thousands of genes may be involved, each one with a very small effect. Genetic potential alone does not predict actual accomplishment. It also takes nurture to grow a genius. Social and cultural influences can provide that nourishment, creating clusters of genius at moments and places in history. Baghdad during Islam's golden age, Kolkata during the Bengal Renaissance, Silicon Valley today. Natural gifts and a nurturing environment can still fall short of producing a genius, without motivation and tenacity propelling one forward. These personality traits, which pushed Darwin to spend 2 decades perfecting On the Origin of Species, and Indian mathematician Srinivasa Ramanujan to produce thousands of formulas, inspire the work of psychologist Angela Duckworth. She believes that a combination of passion and perseverance, what she calls grit, drives people to achieve. Duckworth, herself a MacArthur Foundation genius, says the concept of genius is too easily cloaked in layers of magic, as if great achievement erupted spontaneously with no hard work. She believes there are differences when it comes to an individual talent, but no matter how brilliant a person is, fortitude and discipline are critical to success. Nor does it happen on the first try. The number one predictor of impact is productivity, said Dean Keith Simonton, professor emeritus of psychology at UC Davis and a longtime scholar of genius. Big hits emerge after many attempts. Most articles published in the sciences are never cited by anybody, said Simonton. Most compositions are not recorded. Most works of art aren't displayed. Thomas Edison invented the phonograph and the first commercially viable light bulb, but those were just 2 of the 1,000-plus U.S. patents he was awarded. Some geniuses never get the chance to be productive. Throughout history, women have been denied formal education or deterred from advancing professionally. Mozart's older sister, Maria Anna, a brilliant harpsichordist, had her career cut short by her father when she reached the marriageable age of 18. Half the women in the Terman study ended up as homemakers. People born into poverty or oppression don't get a shot at working toward anything other than staying alive. If you do believe that genius is this thing that can be singled out and cultivated and nurtured, says McMahon, what an incredible tragedy that thousands of geniuses or potential geniuses have withered and died. Sometimes, by sheer good fortune, promise and opportunity collide. If ever there was an individual who personified the concept of genius in every aspect, it was Leonardo da Vinci. Born in 1452 to unmarried parents, Leonardo began life in a stone farmhouse in Italy's Tuscan hills. From these simple beginnings, Leonardo's intellect and artistry soared like Schopenhauer's comet. The breadth of his abilities, his artistic insights, his expertise in human anatomy, his prescient engineering is unparalleled. Today, an international group of scholars and scientists is tracing the artist's genealogy and hunting down his DNA to learn more about his ancestry and physical characteristics, to verify paintings that have been attributed to him, and, most remarkably, to search for clues to his extraordinary talent. Genealogists are tracking down Leonardo's living relatives on his father's side for cheek swabs. Anthropologists are seeking access to remains believed to be Leonardo's at Chateau d'Amboise, a castle in France's Loire Valley, where he was buried in 1519. Historians and geneticists are experimenting with techniques to obtain DNA from fragile Renaissance-era paintings and paper. The quest to unravel the origins of genius may never reach an endpoint. For some, that is as it should be. "I don't want to figure it out at all," says Keith Jarrett when I asked if he is comfortable not knowing how his music takes hold. "If someone offered me the answer, I'd say, take it away." In the end, it may be that the journey is illuminating enough and that the insights it reveals along the way about the brain, about our genes, about the way we think, will nurture glimmers of genius in not just the rare individuals, but in us all. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in National Geographic. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The TV star who made Batman a camp classic. Adam West, 1928-2017. With his classically chiseled features, Adam West might have been just another one of those bland leading men who proliferated in the 1960s. Instead, he became a camp icon in Batman, which burst onto TV screens in 1966, burned out after three seasons, and left a gaudy mark on pop culture. West played a clean-cut, milk-drinking millionaire Bruce Wayne, who secretly doubles as the Caped Crusader and battles crime in Gotham City with his ward, Dick Grayson, a.k.a. Robin the Boy Wonder. Acting alongside a rotating cast of scenery-chomping special guest villains, including Burgess Meredith's Penguin and Cesar Romero's Joker, West proved a flawless straight man with his deadpan delivery and sonorous baritone. He later struggled with typecasting, but ultimately embraced his alter ego. "How many actors get a chance to create a signature role?" West asked. "Not many." Born in Walla Walla, Washington, West was a farmer's son, said the New York Times. After college, he joined the Army and worked in radio and helped create military television stations. West's acting career began in Hawaii, where he co-starred with a chimpanzee on a TV variety show and made 1957's Voodoo Island, a zombie-laden horror movie starring Boris Karloff. Moving to Hollywood, West guested on Perry Mason, 77 Sunset Strip, and just about every Western on television, and appeared in nearly a dozen films, including 1959's The Young Philadelphians, opposite Paul Newman. Batman was a garishly bold supernova, said the Washington Post, with psychedelic sets, skewed camera angles, and fistfights graphically represented with comic book style captions, zap, pow, and bam. West was like a Shakespearean actor who wandered into a slapstick routine, anchoring the zaniness with just a hint of a wink under his unsmiling facade. West's career slumped after Batman, and he was relegated to schlocky B-films, said The Guardian. He later applied his comic timing to self-spoofing cameos on The Simpsons and The Big Bang Theory, and to a 14-year run on Family Guy voicing an insanely corrupt mayor named Adam West. But Batman endured, living on in reruns, something West had predicted. I would tell Batman castmates, I want you please to make this moment, this scene, the best of your life, he recalled, because this show will be lasting. We're going to go right on over to the talking points page. Trump Care, the GOP's secret plan. While the nation was distracted by Trump scandals, Senate Republicans have moved to cripple health care, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. They did it in secret because they know the only way to ram through their hopelessly unpopular Obamacare repeal is to hide the details. With no hearings and no debate, GOP senators have crafted what they're peddling as a kinder version of the House bill, the one the Congressional Budget Office predicts would cost 23 million Americans their health coverage, cut federal subsidies for people to buy policies in half, and reduce Medicaid spending by $834 billion. Leaks indicate the Senate bill will slightly enlarge the subsidies offered in the House bill and put off the painful Medicaid cuts for as long as 7 years, far past the midterm elections. For 8 years, Republicans insisted they could produce a better health care reform plan, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But their only plan is to give the rich a huge tax cut and slash health benefits for the poor and middle class with a minimum level of transparency and accountability. The GOP has no reason to hide its plan, said Robert Ehrlich in WashingtonExaminer.com. President Trump should take the lead and make clear the bill will facilitate competition, lower premiums, and improve health care. It guts Obamacare's 21 new or increased taxes and allows states to opt out of rigid mandates, inviting more flexible, cheaper alternatives into the market and giving consumers more choice. The bill also helps reform a broken Medicaid by giving states block grants instead of unlimited funding. Perhaps Medicaid can now fulfill its original purpose, subsidizing poor women and people with disabilities instead of able-bodied, working-age adults. But there's still a real chance the more moderate Senate bill may not pass, said Burgess Everett in Politico.com. With a 52-48 majority, Republicans have essentially given up on conservatives Rand Paul and Mike Lee, allowing no further defections. Meanwhile, Obamacare is in deep trouble, said Sarah Cliff in Vox.com. Across the nation, panicked health insurers are raising rates or quitting the exchanges altogether, citing uncertainty about the program's future, its funding, and what Republicans will do. Insurers don't want a new law. They want the current law fixed. But Republicans are instead deliberately causing Obamacare's slow collapse because it gives them more ammo for pushing their repeal forward. And some short notes to wind out the hour. The bowling industry, with 69,000 workers, employs more people than the coal industry, which has 51,000. There are more professional dancers, 20,000, in the U.S. than actual coal miners, 15,000. More than half of the roughly 450 nuclear power plants worldwide are nearing the end of their planned lives. Only 17 plants have ever been decommissioned and completely cleaned up, a process that can cost as much as $1.5 billion per facility. Since the Columbine massacre 18 years ago, more than 135,000 students attending at least 164 primary or secondary schools have experienced a shooting on campus. About 19.5 million people watched James Comey's Senate testimony on TV, according to a Nielsen estimate. CNN and MSNBC had about three times their typical audience at those hours. Fox had about twice as many as usual. President Trump reached a 60% disapproval rate in the Gallup tracking poll this week. The earliest in his term a president has sunk that low. It took 2 years of Watergate for Richard Nixon to reach 60% disapproval, while George W. Bush got there in his fifth year. Lyndon Johnson, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton never hit 60%. And let's see, we'll finish up with a quote. This from George Orwell, quoted in the Daily Telegraph. The further a society drifts from the truth, the more it will hate those who speak it. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you have enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments or questions? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.